Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Have you ever thought of what goes on in the mind of a mass shooter? Well, it might surprise you. They are actually not psychotic or insane in a legal sense, but instead are fixated on a grievance or cause, something all of us can learn to detect. And my guest explains how in his new book, FBI consultant and forensic psychologist Tahir Rahman, MD, say that three times real fast, is author along with Jeffrey Epigel of Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, Clinical and Forensic Psychiatric Dimensions. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about Tahir, go to scienceofextremism.com. Tahir, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ira.
So what brought you into this unusual world, given that you are a doctor and you could have gone any which way? You kind of gone into specializing in removing kidney stones, but no,
yeah,
you have
question.
To get into this other world.
I'm a psychiatrist. I'm also a forensic psychiatrist. And I, from time to time, am asked to do insanity evaluations. And I always pondered some of the high profile cases out there, like assassins and terrorism and all of these issues. And I noticed that what we were calling in the lay culture delusions and psychosis was not what psychiatrists thought these people had. And that really sent me on a course to develop a better and newer classification system for criminal behavior involving mass shootings, acts of terror. And, you know, that journey has brought me to really look at the fact that a lot of the people who don't have a diagnosable psychiatric illness actually have something else, something we call extreme overvalued beliefs.
It's an interesting concept that it could be someone who has a fervent belief in whatever it is, but somehow that goes from that belief to taking action, which can be damaging to scores or more of people. So where does that connection come in where you can have a firm misbelief on something even, and you can just live with it yourself, as opposed to having this firm misbelief and taking it out on others because you perceive others as perhaps dangerous to you and your beliefs?
The behavior really seems irrational to outsiders, but within the terrorist or mass shooter's belief system, it flows logically and sequentially. And so an extreme overvalued belief is one that's shared by others in a person's culture, religion, or subculture. The belief is relished, amplified, defended. It slowly becomes more refined, more resistant to challenge. Individuals will develop binary, simplistic, and absolute beliefs. And we think that that's different than a delusion or an obsession, which I'll explain as we go through here. But the person may then carry out violent behavior in the service of the belief. So let's talk about some real simple examples.
Mm-hmm.
September 11, 9/11 attacks. The West is at war with Islam, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Middle East needs to be freed from Western and American influence. These were some of the teachings of Osama bin Laden. On the January 6th attack, we saw Biden is a communist, Trump won the election, hang Mike Pence, and they even erected a gallows in front of the Capitol building. So these kinds of thoughts are called extreme overvalued beliefs because they're shared beliefs within a culture or subculture.
And it's reinforced within the culture as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. With the school shooters, Sandy Hook, Uvalde, Parkland school shootings are some of the big ones here in most people's memories. And there it's the same thing. It's the preoccupation with previous shooters and how grievances of today can be dealt with by turning to prior mass shooters. And so with school shooters, assassins, in my work that I've laid out in my book, I talk about how the shared ideology between these different individuals by doing copycat, going backwards and looking at other shooters is what these individuals often will end up doing. And they relish those behaviors. So there's positive emotions involved in this, and then some negative emotions involved in this.
I want to talk a little bit in a moment about possible solutions on how to deal with those kinds of belief systems, especially when they result in action that's dangerous to a society. But first, with your background, how did you get into the world of psychiatry and psychology, and as opposed to, as I mentioned earlier, in a flippant way, instead of specializing in kidney stones, why did you decide to pursue psychiatry?
Well, I grew up in Kansas. My father was a psychiatrist. I'm sure that had some influence on my thinking. And so when I went to medical school at the University of Kansas, I really got interested in forensic psychiatry. Around that time, the Oklahoma City bombing had occurred in 1995, I believe that was. And I got interested in what the motivations of that were. People kind of rushed to judgment that it must have been a Middle East terrorist that did it, when it actually ended up being an American, you know, former American soldier who did that bombing. And so that kind of started me on my journey of exploring more about the criminal mind. I did my residency in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Hospital, where I met some leading experts in the field of forensic psychiatry, and, you know, people who had worked on Jeffrey Dahmer's case and John Hinckley Jr.'s case, things like that, that were really of interest to me. And what dawned on me pretty quickly is that we didn't have a diagnostic or other classification system for some of these killers. And so in my work, I really have spent time developing this new classification system, which is published in the book and is on my website for further exploration. But in general, I'm an associate professor here at Washington University in St. Louis School of Medicine, where I really am passionate about teaching medical students, psychiatric residents about phenomenology we see in psychiatry. And I'm also kind of a amateur historian. I've written a book on the Apollo 11 moon landing. I'm an avid presidential historian. I enjoy American history and some of the assassins. You know, I've been to where some of these big events have occurred, like where Ford's Theater and where Booth jumped off this, you know, onto the stage there yelling "Sic Semper Tyrannis." So I've been through a lot of different scenarios in terms of actually visiting landmarks and doing my own investigative exploration of the psychology and the science and what we can do to apply rigorous classification systems to individuals who do this.
You ever get too, I don't know what the word would be, personally involved in your field, in the sense that because it's a dark field in a way, that you can get depressed or upset or anxious because you are dealing with thoughts that lead to actions and they're not great actions? So do you take a step back occasionally just to get out of that world?
I think that, you know, I'm really interested in the thinking that's behind the behavior. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at graphic images of the aftermath of a shooting or a killing, you know, I think people who study serial killers have a similar, you know, experience. But yes, it's a depraved subculture of violence. And you got to have a little bit of a sense of humor and dark humor when you're doing this stuff.
I would think so.
And I think that's one way that you cope with it. But it's an interesting question. And we don't spend, you know, all day looking at these individuals. We, you know, I do other things here too. I do breast cancer research. I do, I work on different projects, and I treat patients of different varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't say that it gets too dark or depressing, and certainly you have to have moments to step away from it and do something to distract your mind from those kinds of things.
Such as exercise, which I know you do too.
Yeah, but I think, you know, physicians are very desensitized to a lot of the things we see. You know, we see a lot of very ill patients and a lot of really sad stories and demoralizing stories. But we also have to give people hope that their situation can be rectified or treated in some way. And I think Americans are fundamentally demoralized by this epidemic of mass shooting and school shootings. And no parent should have to send their kid to school knowing that this could end up being their child. And we can do something about it. As we get through this interview, I hope that I can show you some of those things.
Yeah, I want to talk about some possible solutions and techniques to use. When you look at the broad sense of this overvalued belief system, extreme overvalued belief system, which almost sounds redundant, but I've got it down in my head now, extreme overvalued belief. But the book is called Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, Clinical and Forensic Psychiatric Dimensions. It's, yes. It's a tough title, but it explains it all. Do you find that it is more prevalent in Western culture versus any other culture, or is it really worldwide or global?
No, I think that, you know, as long as there's been humans on planet Earth, people have likely developed binary and simplistic thinking. This was probably something that humans needed to do evolutionarily to survive. Let me give you an example. If you know that there's a poisonous snake or a nest full of some dangerous creatures living near a fruit tree, you would go to the village and tell everybody, look, there's scary stuff by that fruit tree. Don't pick the apples or pears or bananas from that area. And that fear spreads quickly when people hear that. So that's a biologically adaptative thing to have, right? Fear response is helpful to avoiding dangerous circumstances. And I think that our moral thinking gets hijacked sometimes by binary thinking. So if we think that our tribe or our belief system is being challenged morally, that's going to create some anger, contempt, you know, disgust towards others. And so if we look at, for example, what happened in the Holocaust and with the extermination of Jews, 6 million Jews, you know, that's an example of how the worst of humanity has made binary, simplistic, and absolute thinking into one of the most heinous, destructive actions ever taken on humans.
Do you think, and this is not a political question, but it's to your point, because you mentioned January 6th, the other side of that coin is what they call Trump derangement syndrome. And there's this attitude towards a person who, if you look at perhaps what his policies are separate from his personality, they're not particularly extreme necessarily. It's within the mainstream of political thought. And yet there's a visceral reaction to him by a lot of people in the United States.
You know, I think it's our job as doctors to educate the public about everything we do, whether it's heart disease or, you know, cancer or diabetes. And these extreme overvalued beliefs are something that we can educate the public about so that we don't have to tell people who, you know, don't vote for this guy or that guy. We really should stay neutral as a field instead of trying to diagnose people from far away, which I think has its own negatives. And our ethical guidelines keep us from doing that. So, you know, what I tell people is, learn about these different historical things, learn about extreme overvalued beliefs, learn about psychopathy, psychopaths, antisocial personality disorders, learn about mood disorders, learn all this stuff. And you'll be able to apply it better to people around you and maybe hopefully select leaders and people that you think have the right stuff.
Before we talk about solutions and techniques, one other question about this phenomenon, and that is, do you see from your study that there is there a part to play with the media and the political establishment in terms of trying to minimize extreme overvalued beliefs, or do they contribute to that extreme overvalued belief system by selective reporting on the media side or by selective politics on the governmental side? And I'm not indicating which side which. I'm just saying, are there these mechanisms in place in our current society that exacerbate the problem rather than to tamp it down?
Sure. I think that, we live in a 24-hour news cycle and people can access it day and night. And, you know, some people refer to that as clickbait, that you see a message or a news story, and unless it really evokes those emotions, fear, anger, disgust, contempt, you know, shame, when it really starts pulling those emotions in, it doesn't tend to get a lot of attention. So by its very nature, a political economic system is going to draw people to binary, simplistic views, because that's what gets the clicks and the money and the revenue that the news sources need. And even if you look at social media and people starting their own interviews and their own channels, often that's the headline that's used to grab a person's attention, is something that's fearful, binary, moralistic, and really hijacks our biological system in order to profit.
That's a good point. So talk to us a little bit about some of the ideas and solutions you've come up with in the book. And again, it's extreme overvalued beliefs, clinical and forensic psychiatric dimensions. And you are looking at the wide range of these beliefs. What did you decide, or what did you find out that there are ways to deal with that?
Sure. So as you mentioned, so scienceofextremism.com is where you can see some of the things I'm going to be talking about here.
Right.
But we can really develop threat analysis from this. And so what I have developed is an innovative classification system, and I have four keys that I have outlined on my website that show you how to evaluate a threat. And so generally speaking, if a threat comes to the radar screen, usually, you know, of law enforcement, but sometimes in the mental health field, emergency room, other places, you have to have some probable cause that a reasonable person might assume that a threat is going to result in a criminal offense of some sort, that a person may pose a threat or danger to themselves and others. And once we've established sort of that probable cause bar, which doesn't require a lot of evidence, it can just require some evidence. And often people can pose a threat without making a threat. And that happens a lot with the school shooters, where they're talking about identifying with old school shooters, for instance. But there's kind of four things to keep in mind. There's people who have delusions that have psychotic symptoms. And these are hallucinations, delusions, and speech disorganization. And most people with these conditions, for example, somebody might have schizophrenia, they generally don't have a big threat to the public. And if they do get violent, it's usually towards a family member or friend. And those are those can be a threat to the public, but are not as much as the extreme overvalued beliefs, which the book is entitled, because those tend to have these shared cultural, religious, or subcultural belief systems. And examples would be Nicholas Cruz saying, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter," or "the West is at war with Islam," or "Black people are replacing white people," or, "Jews are disgusting." These kinds of extreme overvalued beliefs require a different approach. So instead of using antipsychotic medicines like we might in a delusional patient with schizophrenia, instead we would use a crisis response team approach where you would remove weapons from the person's home, and then you would engage in looking at comorbid illnesses that the person may have. For example, there may be substance use, there may be depression, there may be anxiety. We can treat those. And we think that some of these individuals have psychological things in their environment that's making things worse. It could be grief, losses, financial stressors, marital stressors or relationship stressors, school stressors, and fundamentally trouble with work, family, community functioning. And by going in and providing some guidance for these individuals, we can do a lot in terms of trying to thwart another mass shooting. And some of these individuals have flat out said, "If somebody had just come talk to me, maybe this would not have happened." There's shooters who have actually plain spokenly said that. So there's plenty of opportunity. Crisis response teams are something that we underutilize and need to use a lot more. And I'll tell you why. Law enforcement can't come in and arrest somebody who poses a threat because they may not have actually made a threat. And they'd never reach the legal threshold of getting a criminal charge. So they can't just be hauled off to jail and locked away forever. And eventually they're going to come out anyway because they haven't committed a criminal offense. Number two, you can't say, "Well, the psychiatrists all and the mental health people all need to take care of these people," because doctors don't want people making threats in their office either. Doctors don't want a person who's armed to the hilt to come into their offices or to the emergency room, like that. Also, these individuals don't think that there's anything wrong with them. They relish their beliefs, right? If you hate Jews or immigrants or think that, Black people are the cause of bad things in the world, you're not going to go to a psychiatrist or doctor and say, "I'm having these thoughts, please make them go away." That's not what these individuals are doing. So they're brought to the radar by others, usually, a spouse, a neighbor, a brother, a sister, a coworker. These are the kinds of ways that the case comes to the radar screen. And so there's this canyon. It's not even a gap, it's a canyon in the middle of law enforcement's over here and can't do much. Mental health system can't do much. So what do we do in the middle here, this no man's land? What we really need to do is use crisis response teams, because you do need the combination of the teeth of law enforcement to make the environment safe. Get rid of guns, weapons, knives, things like that. And then to engage in these other psychological and sociological aspects of the case to see what's going on. And I think that that's something that certainly government, health insurance, other things can help us with. And the American people need to demand health insurance companies, government programs do more for this. And it's unacceptable for us to, again, send our kids to school wondering if they're going to come home to us safely because of this stuff.
When you wrote the book, did you aim it at a combination of audiences? And what I mean by that is law enforcement,
Great question.
other workers in the psychological field, as well as the general public?
It's a great question. I started out writing it for doctors, for psychiatrists, for mental health, people in mental health. And as we got into really writing it, I went to my editor and I said, look, doctors, psychiatrists already know some of this stuff. They know that antipsychotic drugs are not going to treat this. That's not what's going to help us stop this epidemic. We need to have a book that's accessible to all people who are interested in this topic, school counselors, school teachers, colleges, professors, law enforcement, profilers, so we need a whole host of, because people work in teams usually with crisis response anyway, so everyone needs to understand it. And secondly, this is not rocket science. It's actually pretty simple. There's a big difference between a person who has delusions and hallucinations and needs to be on medication and somebody who's relishing, amplifying, and defending their belief system at home, which may actually be shared by other people. I'll give you an example. Somebody might be emotional about abortion, that abortion is wrong, abortion is evil, abortion is murder. And there was an abortion performing doctor in Wichita, Kansas, where I'm originally from, who was shot in the head while he was in church at point blank range by an anti-abortion activist. And so this kind of thinking is often shared by others in that culture. And so it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of people thought, gee, that's great, this abortion doctor's dead now and good for him, even though they wouldn't go do it themselves. So it's important to note that the behavior may look irrational and aberrant, but actually within their belief system, people often follow or may even secretly like the fact that that happened.
Although it's, if you're pro-life, you have to be pro-life for everybody, but at least that would be the logic of, I would think, of everybody, but maybe not.
Yeah, for the extremist, it's within their belief system, it all flows rationally. Mm-hmm. But if you believe that September 11 attacks, flying an airplane into a building and dying will martyr you, and there's 72 virgins awaiting in heaven for the martyr, and that the West is at war with Islam, and that these holy sites in Saudi Arabia need to be liberated from American dominance in the area, those kinds of extreme overvalued beliefs flow rationally within the belief system. And you might think, gee, that was 20 years ago, but we just had a very recent threat against Taylor Swift's concert in Europe, in Austria, where three members of ISIS, teenage boys, have been radicalized, and information is still coming out on exactly what they believe. But ISIS creates videos, propaganda videos, and so this threat is still looming today, even though it may feel like that was a long, long time ago. We still need to be on alert and guard for this kind of behavior.
We have about a minute left. What would you like people to take from reading your book? I'm sure there's many points, but what would be the main point that you'd like people to get from your book?
I think that we need to educate Americans, really worldwide even, about extreme overvalued beliefs, because if we all know and understand that binary, simplistic, and absolute thinking, that a person can go down that rabbit hole pretty quickly and easily, then we can recognize it both in ourselves and not push that next share button on social media, which shares it with thousands of people or even millions of people. That's one way to help slow this down, this kind of thinking. And number two, to know that it's all around you and that there could be signs and worrisome things in people, and that it's okay to get help. And there's an organization called Parents for Peace that can help. And so if somebody's, you know, reading QAnon material or ISIS material or radicalizing about abortion or their political ideology or, you know, getting ready to mobilize weapons and do things that are very worrisome, that it's okay to call for help, and that it's not just about being punitive with law enforcement. There's actually ways to treat this and that we can do something.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been FBI consultant and forensic psychologist Tahir Rahman, MD. He's author, along with Jeffrey Abigail, of Extreme Overvalued Beliefs, Clinical and Forensic Psychiatric Dimensions. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Tahir, go to scienceofextremism.com. And Tahir, thank you for being on the show.
It was great, Ira. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.